thank you very much for being with us for this first part of the briefing, but we will continue with two other interesting and important speakers. And I'd like to go straight to Rome, where Jean-Martin Bauer is waiting for us. Jean-Martin, you all know Jean-Martin. He is the WFP Director of Food Security and Nutrition Analysis. Jean-Martin, bonjour. Merci d'être avec nous à Genève ce matin. And you are going to brief us on the latest IPC food security analysis and needs in Afghanistan. You have the floor, sir. Thank
you very much. Good morning, Geneva. I'm here this morning to tell you about the most recent IPC report for Afghanistan. This report is unfortunately confirming fears we had about food insecurity in Afghanistan. The situation is getting worse, and we need to act now as Afghanistan is entering the winter period where needs are highest. What the IPC tells us is that more than 17 million people in Afghanistan are facing acute food insecurity. That is 3 million more than last year. So the situation is getting measurably worse. There are almost 4 million children in a situation of acute malnutrition. This is a group that's quite vulnerable at this time of year. Again, there's the onset of winter. This is when there's a seasonal peak in vulnerability, when there's a peak in impacts on young children, and this is when we need to be able to act. Now, why are we in this situation? There have been a confluence of factors. There's been a drought in Afghanistan. Many parts of Afghanistan received insufficient rains, which impacted crops and livestock. There have also been a large number of returnees to Afghanistan this year. More than 2.5 million people were forcibly returned to Afghanistan from Iran and Pakistan earlier this year. And this is putting stress on very limited resources, on the very limited infrastructure in the country and causing some of the vulnerability we're seeing right now. There have also been earthquakes in Afghanistan. And there's been the impact of funding cuts. There is only very limited assistance reaching the Afghan population right now. And this altogether is coming into a head as we enter the winter in the country. Now, I'd like to emphasize that for the World Food Program, we're not able to implement the usual winterization program that we have in Afghanistan, which involves pre-positioning food resources in vulnerable communities, and this is for lack of funding. However, if we do get resources, we have the people, we have the trucks, the contracts, the relationships, the access to provide assistance to the population. But people need to step up now in order for us to avert the most, I'd say the most extreme impacts in the country. Now, what we need is $570 million over the next 6 months to provide essential assistance to about 6 million people in Afghanistan. Right now, we need to make sure that the country remains in the headlines, that Afghanistan remains top of mind because of the very high levels of vulnerability that are confirmed right now through this IPC. I'm available to questions, over to you.
Thank you very much, Jean-Martin. I look at the, yes, Christian, the German News Agency.
Hello. Just some clarifications on the numbers. Did you say 4 million children face malnutrition? Can you give us an idea out of how many altogether or a percentage? You say 6 million people need aid. Does that mean 4 million children plus 2 million adults? And of the $570 million that you need for the next 6 months, how much do you have at this point? Thank you.
Marta.
All right. So the, is it back to me?
Yeah. Go ahead. We answer one question after the other. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, on malnutrition, what you need to note is that there are 3.7 million children in Afghanistan that are acutely malnourished. Of those, about 1 million are severely acutely malnourished, and those are children who actually require hospital treatment. So it's a large number. It's a number that's increased as a result of the curtailing of essential services in Afghanistan. I could give you the overall number later if you need that, but it is a large number. It is quite concerning. Now, the you're asking about the funding request we have. Actually, I'm told that it's 468, the takeaway number. You should note $468 million. That is needed to assist, for WFP to assist 6 million people in Afghanistan over the next 6 months. The overall numbers in terms of needs, let's just make sure those are absolutely clear. You've got 17 million people, according to the IPC, who are acutely food insecure. That's acute food insecurity. Then there's nutrition. And nutrition is 3.7 million children. In terms of assistance, we want to help 6 million people with $468 million. I hope that's clear.
And how much of that do you have already? How much of that sum?
It's look, we are in trouble. Our resourcing this year has been only 12% of what we asked for. So we're at very, very low levels. We are supporting fewer than 1 million people per month in Afghanistan right now. We need to get that up to 6 million. A scale up is needed.
Thank you very much. Then I'll go to EFE, Spanish news agency.
Thank you. I wanted to ask if you know if women are more affected by this hunger crisis, because maybe they are not able to access to the resources or to the help that you are providing. Thank you.
Absolutely. Women are one of the most vulnerable groups in Afghanistan. We know that they've been largely excluded from social life, and that's a huge a challenge. What my colleagues in Afghanistan tell me is that mothers especially are turning up at health centers with children, hoping for a ration, hoping for some support for their children, and unfortunately in many cases being turned away because resources are no longer available. So when we look at the vulnerability in Afghanistan, it's women, it's children that are being affected the most.
Very clear. Jimmy Keaton, Associated Press.
Hello, Mr. Bauer. Thank you for coming to see us. My two questions are the first. Yeah. Can you hear me?
It's red.
No, not yet.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bauer, for coming to see us. I just had two questions. The first is, what kind of issues are you seeing with access with regard to the Taliban leadership in Afghanistan? Is there anything that is left to be desired in terms of access, and what kind of constraints are you facing? And secondly, because you're in Rome, what are Ms. McCain and other top leaders of WFP telling the U.S. government in particular about restoring funding? Can you give us some insight into those conversations, please? Thank you.
In terms of access in Afghanistan, WFP has fairly good access in the country. We're able to implement our programs. Just a few years ago, we were able to have a very large scale-up of our activities in Afghanistan when needs were high as a result, again, of a drought. It's been a protracted crisis in Afghanistan, as you know. Access is not the number one problem for WFP. We have we're well embedded in communities. We're in touch with leaders and able to get the resources to the most vulnerable parts of the country right now. The real problem for us in terms of being able to deliver and respond to the vulnerability that the IPC report confirms today is really the funding. That's what we need to be able to do our job. WFP continues to talk to all of its donors and sensitize its donors about the importance of providing support to countries in a situation of vulnerability. Afghanistan is part of those conversations, but I couldn't get into more detail about exactly what's being said and to who.
Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up in the room. So on the platform, Nick Cumming Bruce, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. There's been sporadic reporting from Afghanistan indicating, you know, really dire conditions, particularly for newborns and pregnant mothers. I'm wondering, though, can you say that there are children who are dying of malnutrition at this point? Are their deaths attributable to malnutrition? And in the sort of global hierarchy of crises, where does the Afghanistan crisis stand? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, Nick, what the IPC tells you is that you've got phase four in some parts of the country. This is for the winter. This is going to be the case in places with higher elevations, the north of the country, and that's also forecasted to be the case after in the spring in the south. The acute malnutrition analysis we have also shows very high levels of malnutrition in the south of the country. So this is when you get to phase four in IPC parlance. It does mean that you're above benchmarks for malnutrition. So for those who don't know the IPC, it's a 5-point system. One is normal, two is stress, three is crisis, four is emergency, and five is catastrophe. So when you get areas in phase four, it means you've exceeded certain thresholds in terms of malnutrition. And what we're seeing is that you've got 3.7 million children who are now in acute malnutrition in the country. 1 million of them severely acutely malnourished. Many of them require treatment right now. So yes, children are dying. This is what the report is saying, and we need action right now to be able to mitigate this. This is the time when people need to step up. This is the winter when the conditions are the harshest in the country, and assistance is needed now. So when you've got phase four levels of food insecurity, that does indicate that this is a worsening crisis and one that deserves all of our attention.
Thank you very much. sorry, Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. The other, sorry, I think there was another part of the question on on where. I mean, if we can speak about the hierarchy, because obviously this is that's the question of the journalist.
Well, my answer to that is that I don't want to have a list of crises from 1 to 20 telling you which one is worse. What I'm telling you is that the people in phase four conditions in Afghanistan, and you've got phase four conditions in Afghanistan, they're just as vulnerable as people in phase four conditions in other countries. And that's actually quite high up the ladder of need. So what you have in Afghanistan is a crisis that's gone broader because it's 3 million more people in acute food insecurity. We were at 14 million last year. We're now at 17 million. So it's more people. But you also have this year areas that are classified as a phase four. You didn't have those areas in phase three. So we're getting into a darker shade of severity. We're getting into a deeper crisis in Afghanistan. And when you get to emergency situations, emergency food security situations, again, you don't have that many. I could try to mention some places with equivalent levels of food insecurity worldwide, but you've got places in East Africa, definitely some spots in West Africa. Haiti's got phase four conditions. So you're looking at that type of crisis. Yemen has got that type of crisis. For more context on exactly where Afghanistan stands as well, you could look at the recent hunger hotspot report that WFP and FAO published in early November. And Afghanistan is right there with the dozen more vulnerable countries in the world. It's a place that needs to have much more attention. And I think one key factor for Afghanistan is the fact that funding is so low. So I've said it that a few times, it's we're only 12% funded in Afghanistan, and that's a complicating factor that really distinguishes the country compared to others.
Thank you very much. So I'll go to Gabriela now.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you for coming to the briefing. My question is, who has access to the food and things in Afghanistan? Who is the one that is having everything? And you know, Afghanistan is not a poor country. I mean, they have resources, they have money. So who is taking all the benefits of the people?
So Gabriela, I'm not sure I have all the answers to the question, but what I can tell you is that the work that we do in Afghanistan is guided by the humanitarian principles. For the World Food Program, it's important to always abide by neutrality, impartiality, humanity, and independence in everything we do. We have direct access to communities, and we're able to identify and target people benefiting from assistance. So our processes in the country respond to that. I think that's as much as I can say. There are probably other issues you might want to know about. What what I want to emphasize is that our work is guided by the humanitarian principles in the country.
Gabriela, you have a follow-up.
Yes, thank you. No, I'm not questioning your work. Mm-hmm. Your humanitarian work is incredible, what you are doing with the sources that you have. My question is, if Taliban is taking everything, all the resources, all the money, and the people is left away because only Taliban receives the benefits. Is that correct?
Look, the analysis we have on Afghanistan shows that it's a protracted crisis. It's a crisis that didn't start, unfortunately, just a few months ago. It's been long running. Very little infrastructure, very few jobs. There are problems with the economy in Afghanistan. There's a very high level of poverty in the country, a very high level of inequality as well, and that lays the foundation for a food crisis. When there's a drought, when there are returnees from enlarged movements of population, when there are earthquakes, which is what we see right now. I don't think I could comment directly on the those social dynamics, but what we have in the country is a pervasive poverty, very low resource base, and therefore these external problems, the natural hazards I've described, and the return of all these millions of refugees to the country is causing tremendous problems for the country.
Thank you. And just one second, Emma, because John has been waiting. John Tarokos, France 24 and The Lancet, and then I'll come to you.
Yes, good morning, Jean-Martin. Following up on Nick's question, I was wondering if you could elaborate. You mentioned 1 million children are suffering from severe acute malnutrition. If that's correct, do we know how many of these children are getting therapeutic feeding? And I presume a World Food Program is assisting in that. And if you have an update on the famine situation in parts of Sudan and Gaza. Thank you.
Okay, so on the number of children supported by WFP, so I'll have to get back to you with a specific number. I don't have that with me right now. Like I mentioned, we are only 12% funded. This is an obstacle. We need to be able to provide what we call blanket supplementary feeding to prevent children falling into severe acute malnutrition. Prevention is always easier than having to cure children who end up in a state of severe acute malnutrition. And one of the recommendations of the IPC is to ensure that this blanket supplementary feeding program does take place. Now you asked about Gaza and Sudan. I think this is, I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't have an update for the group right now.
Yeah, no worries. We knew you were coming for Afghanistan. And I'm also seeing in the chat, in the messages I'm receiving to make sure, but I think it's been done, that Ishita and Asfar can send your notes to the journalist very quickly if it's not been done already. Gabriela, is this a new hand or an old hand?
Yeah, it was a new hand because I had a question on Afghanistan for Human Rights Office.
But unfortunately, they are not here today.
Oh, they are not here today?
No, OHCHR is not. You said OHCHR or UNHCR?
No, no, the Human Rights Office.
No, they are not here today. So please contact directly Ravina and her team for this. Gabriela, thank you.
They were absent last week as well. Okay.
Okay, Gabriela, thank you very much. But let me thank especially Jean-Martin for coming to the briefing and for all this information. And again, Emma, I promise I come to you. Sorry, I forgot Reuters. Go ahead, Emma.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer. I don't know if you've been to Afghanistan recently. Could you just paint the picture of how you're making these tough decisions on the ground if you don't have enough to feed everyone that needs it? I've heard anecdotes of literally you take the queue and then you just have to turn the rest of them away. Is that happening and what does it look like? And then secondly, FuseNet was down earlier this year for a while during the first phase of the Trump aid cuts. And some humanitarians I spoke to said that that would have consequences in the long term because there wouldn't be all the data to be able to tell donors what the needs were for places like Afghanistan. And that would slow down funding in the pipeline. I was wondering if you think that the cuts to FuseNet have actually played a role in the situation that Afghanistan is in today with hunger? Thank you.
So thanks, Emma. So the choice my colleagues in Afghanistan are facing is between prioritizing people of equally vulnerable status, and that's what you get when you're only 12% funded. If the funding were more than that, you'd try to prioritize and really try to help the most vulnerable. But we're down to a state where you've got people with the same level of extreme vulnerability, and we're only able to help a few. That's really the situation right now. That's what happens when funding cuts are as deep as they've been in Afghanistan. What we try to do is target hotspots. We have an early warning mechanism in the country that identifies the most vulnerable areas. We target the most vulnerable within those areas, but we do know that we're covering a subset of the needs. For instance, last summer there was and this is when we had about 10 million people acutely food insecure in Afghanistan. We're only able to do support for about, I think it was about 600,000 people. So you see, we're really targeting a very small number, and that's quite problematic in itself. You mentioned you asked about FuseNet and the role in Afghanistan. I would say that the IPC in Afghanistan has been able to continue without with the actors who are present in country, and we've been able to collect data throughout Afghanistan. We've been able to continue monitoring markets. We've been able to continue monitoring nutrition indicators. And in fact, this is data that's collected independently of FuseNet. This is the different UN agencies. It's the NGOs. We're able to collect information that helps us make these assessments. I think where the role of FuseNet is very important is in being the relay with the U.S. government. Now FuseNet is active. We are in touch with them on a regular basis. But I do want to assure you that in places like Afghanistan, WFP and other UN agencies and other humanitarian agencies at the local level and quite often the governments are able to continue producing the data we need to inform these types of analyses.
Jean-Martin, really thank you so much for this important update. I really hope that your appeal for more funding is heard so that your colleagues in the field don't have to do these extremely dire choices. So thanks again for coming to the briefing here in Geneva. Come back anytime. And I'm counting on your colleagues for the notes. Thanks again. Merci beaucoup, Monsieur Jean-Martin Bauer. Merci beaucoup. And now let me turn to my right for a briefing by WHO. Tariq has brought us Dr. Wen Qing Zhang. I hope I pronounced it well. Who is the unit head for global respiratory threats of the Department of Epidemic and Pandemic Threats Management of WHO. I'll give the floor first to Tariq, and then maybe Dr. Zhang update us on the influenza, something that touches upon all of us at the moment.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. Yes, you know Dr. Zhang, Wenqing Zhang. She was here last year. She was talking about avian flu. She is heading our unit for global respiratory threats. So we wanted today to speak about seasonal influenza. So I'll give the floor to Dr. Zhang, and you will receive her notes as she speaks.
Thank you so much, Tariq, for the introduction. Actually, it's a great pleasure to be here in this time of the year. With the Northern Hemisphere winter season, flu or influenza season and other respiratory viruses are surging. Although global influenza levels have been within the expected range so far this season, since October, some countries reported early starts to their influenza seasons and quickly reached epidemic levels. And some countries in the Southern Hemisphere have seen unusually prolonged flu seasons. We have seen the emergence and the rapid expansion of a new AH3N2 virus subclade called J.2.4.1, aliased as K. The subclade K virus was first noted in August in Australia and New Zealand, and has since detected in over 30 countries in all regions globally, except to date, South America. Current epidemiological data do not indicate an increase in disease severity, although this genetic shift makes a notable evolution in the virus. Influenza viruses change quickly, and that's why we need to regularly update the influenza vaccine composition. WHO tracks these changes, assesses associated risks to public health, and makes vaccine composition recommendation twice a year through a long-standing global system, the Global Influenza Surveillance and Response System, or GISIS, in collaboration with other global experts. Although this new variant is not part of the composition of the current vaccines for Northern Hemisphere season, early evidence suggests that current seasonal vaccines continue to offer protection against severe diseases and reduce the risk of hospitalization. Vaccination remains our most effective defense, including against drifted strains, particularly for high-risk population and those taking care of them. Along with the flu, we are seeing circulation of other respiratory viruses, including RSV, SARS-CoV-2, and rhinoviruses. In some countries, in addition to the burden of respiratory-related hospitalizations, healthcare systems have been further strained by the seasonal rise of other viruses, such as norovirus. With the upcoming holiday season, there is a potential risk of a surge in respiratory illness. Therefore, advanced planning and preparedness efforts, including encouraging vaccination uptake and strengthening health system readiness, are strongly recommended. WHO is continuing monitoring the situation not only on seasonal influenza, but also on avian influenza and swine influenza potential or pandemic risk, jointly with partners and supporting countries. Countries are urged to strengthen lab diagnostics and year-round disease surveillance, participating in the WHO's Global Influenza Surveillance and Response System, GISIS, if not yet a member of the network. Conduct integrated surveillance of respiratory viruses, testing viruses of public health importance, for example, SARS-CoV-2 and RSV, in addition to influenza. Whenever feasible, sequence a subset of these viruses in accordance with WHO guidance and share the genetic sequence data in a timely manner via publicly accessible databases. Countries are also urged to encourage high vaccination coverage, especially among high-risk groups, in no priority order, health and care workers, older people, pregnant women, those with chronic or immunocompromising conditions. Reinforce infection control in healthcare settings and promote rapid antiviral treatment according to WHO's clinical management guidelines and relevant national guidance. So in summary, while flu activity remains within expected seasonal bounds, the widespread presence of a new virus subclade, the early rise and subsequent heightened activity in some countries signal the importance of vigilance and preparedness. Vaccination, disease and laboratory surveillance, and robust public health intervention are crucial to protecting community during this flu season.
Thank you very much for this very comprehensive update. And as you said, the notes are going out. Okay, so let's start with the questions. Christian, Eric.
Thank you very much for this update. You are talking about how countries and hospitals should be prepared, but what can you tell people who are going to see their enlarged family over the holiday season? What could individuals do to minimize their risk of infection? Thank you.
Especially with older parents.
Yeah, so on the WHO's website, there's a relevant guidance available. But practically, of course, countries first need to examine whether they have already vaccinated or not. This is particularly important if they are joining a big family and within the family members, they are the elderly or they are people, you know, with underlying conditions which belongs to the risk groups. This is extremely important. And then implement those common practice like wash hand, avoid going to the crowded, you know, crowded places. For those elderly or elderly people, especially for those elderly or those underlying my diseases, try to refrain from those crowded places. This is extremely important. If anyone noticed they have respiratory symptoms, they need to seek their GP or medical consultation and to get the diagnostic done. Meanwhile, before the diagnostic's done, meanwhile, to try to stay at home and not mix with the crowd, just to avoid if it is a flu or other viruses and get spread.
Emma Farge, Reuters.
Hey, good morning. Obviously, this happens every winter, and so I was just wondering if you could make it a bit clearer whether it's worse than previous years and why, and whether the vaccines that we have against the flu are effective this year. And secondly, it's a question on the US participation in the global GISRS. I see that they're a participating member. They have an office in Atlanta. Will that change after January 22nd? And if so, if they're no longer in this network, What are the consequences of that for fighting respiratory diseases? Thank you.
So with regards so far this season, as we are still at the very early of this season, although we've seen some of the media reports that the early arrival of the season or a bad season, etc., but still it's very early. And so far we haven't seen indicators of a severe season or more severe season than previous. Although there's such a new subclade virus, subclade K virus emerging and circulating in many parts of the world. With regards to the vaccine, again, the vaccine effectiveness are being monitored in many countries. So far this season, because we are still in the early season, but there's early estimates also available. And like in UK, some weeks ago, they published the early estimation of the vaccine effectiveness data. It's quite promising. They estimated the vaccine effectiveness against that particular new variant. Actually, the results coming out promising is that it gives evidence of around 75% of effectiveness among children against the severe diseases and hospitalization, and 35% among the adults of those. So these results are quite moderate in comparison with previous seasons. With regards to U.S. Participation in GISRS, so far, U.S. is a member of the GISRS, and they've been participating according to the terms of reference of GISRS in the WHO's Global Influenza Surveillance and Response System. Actually, we don't know what would happen post January next year, but from the flu perspective, from the respiratory surveillance and preparedness perspective, certainly we would need all the countries in the world to participate participate in the surveillance, preparedness, and response for influenza and other respiratory viruses, because we don't know the next pandemic, the strain, when and where it would emerge. And that time between the emergence and being picked up and characterized and put into vaccines, it would make a lot of difference with regards to the number of lives that could be saved.
Other question in the room, or I'll go to the platform. Okay, so let me see. Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Thank you for coming. Sorry. Thank you for coming to the briefing. My question is, you mentioned that this new virus, H, I don't know the number, is not affecting Latin America. Do you know why? What are the causes that is not arriving to Latin America? Is Latin America more healthy, or what is happening there? And also, if you can talk about the race of measles in several parts of the world, for example, Mexico, the cases are incredibly high, and we have a vaccine, but it looks like they don't have vaccines in Mexico for the kids, or they are not vaccinating the children. Do you know what is happening with measles? Thank you so much. I know that you come for H1N1, but maybe you can talk about this, or maybe Tariq. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I think the measles. I'll be happy to have a look when I get back to the office, and see if we have something specifically on Mexico. But Dr. Zhang can take on a flu strain.
Yeah, so thanks very much for your question. So first, the new variant. The new variant is called J.2.4.1 subclade, because it's very complicated. So there's an alias called K. So we call it subclade K virus. It is an H3N2. H3N2 basically is a seasonal circulating virus, because flu virus is constantly changing. And this subclade K virus is a newly emerged subclade of these circulating viruses. So you are right that so far, actually, this virus has not yet been detected in South America. But with the season going on, and especially with the upcoming Southern Hemisphere in 2026, I would not be surprised that we will be able to detect this variant. Subclade K viruses. But nevertheless, the circulating influenza viruses, there are many clades or many subtypes. For example, there's H1N1 and also influenza B. Even among the H3N2 viruses, there are different clades. There are J.2.2 and J.2.3, etc. So actually, at the moment, in Caribbeans and in North Africa, the H3N2 virus and the H1N1 virus are equally circulating in those. So this comes again back to the vaccines. The flu vaccine contains the three components, H1N1, H3N2, and B. Although the component of H3N2 not exactly react well the newly emerged clade, but certainly this vaccine provide protection against the infection of other circulating viruses like H1N1 and B as well.
Gabriela, you have a follow-up?
Yes, I have a question for Tariq that is there. Tariq, I would like to know about the funding of WHO. How are you doing after the departure of United States government? I would like to know that. And how do you see health in the USA? Because the people there also... there are poor people in the United States. So what is your assessment on this issue? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Gabriela. I think Dr. Tedros was speaking at length last week when he met members of ACANU, and many of you were there on this topic. And we've been speaking about it throughout this year. WHO has started the reform in 2017, so years before these cuts. And one of the things that have been identified was reliance on handful of donors, and we have been trying since then to diversify our donor base. We were also asking member states to increase the assessed contributions, and member states agreed to increase assessed contributions by 50% and over years until 2030. One, nevertheless, these cuts, these financial cuts, meant that we had to do some prioritization and alignment, including staff reduction and reducing operational costs. But again, WHO is really doing its best to stabilize the financing, and that again, we are given mandate by the member states to do a certain number of things, and we need to do those things. So we are doing what we can to align with the priorities that are given to us by member states. When it comes to situation in particular countries, we've been always talking about universal health coverage, and this is really something that there is a meeting going on in Japan these days on universal health coverage. And basically, it is countries are different. They have different health systems. They have different health financing systems. There is no one recipe for all countries when it comes how to run the health system. But what we try really to emphasize that having everyone being able to access basic health services and to have access to affordable medicine is something that is a part of a rights to health, which is part of a human rights. So everyone should be able to get access to immunization, to prenatal, postnatal care, to emergency care, regardless of the financial situation. So really, universal health coverage is the concept that we hope all countries would follow.
Thank you very much. Gabriela, is that new hand or old hand? I'd like to go to Nick.
Sorry. Yes, it's a new hand. Tariq, how is going to affect that cut of funding that you're talking about, that you have to release a lot of people in your office. So the people that are working are going to have tons of work. How is going to affect your operations in your office there in Geneva? Thank you so much. Sorry for asking so much questions. Sorry.
No, it's okay. So basically, we are really looking into what is a priority for the organization and what can be done, what is being done maybe by someone else, and then we don't duplicate. So all the departments are going through that process of looking what is really essential according to the mandate that is given to us by member states, and what is maybe done by other international health partners, and what maybe can be scaled down. So this is the concept of prioritization and alignment. But again, the core mandate is something that WHO will continue to perform.
Thank you very much, Nick. I mean, Bruce, your times.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. It's a question for Dr. Zhang, really, on the avian influenza outbreak in the United States. I wonder if you have any sense of the trajectory on that. It doesn't seem to have diminished in terms of its geographic spread. I'm wondering if you're seeing more or less outbreaks in relation to poultry and wildlife. And I wondered also if you had seen any evolution of the virus that made it more of a threat for human transmission. CDC still rates this outbreak as a low risk to the public. Do you share that analysis? Thank you.
Yes, thanks very much for your question. Actually, influenza is always evolving. is evolution, it continues. And this is the reason why there's such a need that I repeated several times that we need a global system. The GISIS, etc., people sharing the information, sharing virus material, etc., for what? One of the very important actions that the WHO is coordinating is a risk assessment. And one of the risk questions is your third question, actually, is what actually is how close we are, or whether this virus is evolving into a more dangerous virus that might cause a human pandemic itself. So, yes, so actually, if we go to the FAO WHO's website, we can see that every week there have been reports of outbreak in poultry reported. And that includes globally in Europe, but also in North America as well. And probably also to mention that the viruses at the moment causing outbreak in poultry, or most outbreaks in poultry in North America, is different from the virus that caused outbreak in dairy cattle. It is a different genotype. From those from dairy cattle is B313, and now actually being circulated and cause outbreak in poultry in North America is D11, a different genotype. Although it is still H5N1 virus, still it belongs to 3.4.4b clade, but the virus itself already different. And the difference again is because of the reassortment with the migratory birds and the local North America low-pass viruses, the reassortment, and then got spread into poultry, causing outbreaks in poultry and further spread of those. So the risk assessment so far, actually WHO, we also give our risk that the public health risk of the current circulating H5N1 for the public health is still low, or the virus, the current virus itself. But the risk of causing infection among those have the occupational exposure or have other exposure, then it's low to medium, low to moderate itself. By saying that, if there's amino acid changes in these viruses, the virus could quickly turn into a more dangerous format. And that's also the reason we've been kept on close eye on the evolution, and then to characterize that and to see to assess the risk associated to the changed format of the viruses.
Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up in the room either. So thank you so very much, Tariq and Dr. Zhang, for coming and giving us this important update. I think that's all we have in the briefing, because I don't have any announcements. As you know, the treaty bodies are not meeting until next year. And therefore, Gabriela, you have a hand up. Was that for Tariq still? He's still in the room.
No. It's for you, Alessandra. Mm. To the last briefing of the year?
Yeah, I was going to give a little bit of a housekeeping, indeed. So let me give you a couple of information about the following weeks. So on Friday, we will have the last briefing of 2025. Then we hopefully will enjoy a little bit of rest for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then we will start again the briefing next year on the 6th of January. Obviously, we will be sending you all the information that's published, that is issued by the UN, and if there was anything important or exceptional, which we hope will not be the case, we will obviously come back with in person. But this is the situation. Solange has sent you a list of the spokespersons who are on duty during these weeks, so don't hesitate to contact them if you have a precise question. Gabriela, does it answer your question, or you had also other requests?
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So Merry Christmas, Have a nice time, relax. Merry Christmas to all my colleagues. So thank you so much for all your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and that of course was my final line, which I am also going to share with you, Gabriella, and with all the journalists. But I will do it on Friday more than today. But thank you very much for following us, and thanks for following this long briefing. And I'll see you on Friday for the last briefing of the year. Thank you.